If you heard my recent podcast with Grandmaster Jan Gustafsson and FIDE Master Donnie Ariel, you might have been surprised to hear that Donnie is spending 10 hours editing each 10-minute video that he does without hiring help. If you're in a situation like Donnie, you should hire help. And if you're looking to hire help quickly, then you should use Indeed.com. When it comes to hiring, Indeed is all you need. So stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other sites. Indeed's sponsored jobs help you stand out and hire fast. With sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates so you can reach the people you want faster. And it makes a huge difference. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. One of the great things about Indeed is that it makes hiring faster so that you can focus on other priorities within your work, such as Donnie actually making the videos rather than editing the videos. Plus, with Indeed sponsored jobs, there are no monthly subscriptions, no long-term contracts, and you only pay for results. How fast is Indeed? In the minute I've been talking to you, 23 hires were made on Indeed, according to the Indeed data worldwide. So there's no need to wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/chess. Just go to Indeed.com/chess right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/chess. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring, Indeed is all you need. Starting your own business can be extremely challenging. I know because of the challenges I faced when starting the Perpetual Chess podcast back in 2016. I had some good friends in the chess world, but suddenly you have to figure out a bunch of stuff like editing, finding guests, making a website, making logos. It was a lot to figure out. And I wish when I was starting that I had a tool like Shopify to help me get started. Shopify is the commerce platform behind millions of businesses around the world, and 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. is from household names like Mattel and Gymshark, just to name a couple brands. Get started with your own design studio with hundreds of ready-to-use templates. Shopify helps you build a beautiful online store to match your brand style. You can accelerate your content creation. Shopify is packed with helpful AI tools that write product descriptions, page headlines, and even enhance your product photography. Get the word out as if you have a marketing team behind you. Easily create email and social media campaigns wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling. And best yet, Shopify is your commerce expert with world-class expertise in everything from managing inventory to international shipping to processing returns and beyond. If you're ready to sell, you're ready for Shopify. So turn your big business idea into with Shopify on your side. Sign up for your $1 per month trial and start selling today at shopify.com/chess. That's shopify.com/chess. Go to shopify.com/chess.
When the technology we need helps us achieve the things we want.
Hey, Lexus, send a text to Bay. I sold my app. Let's celebrate.
Cracking the code of success is as effortless as your excellence. Recode your future with the tech-forward and tech-ready Lexus NX. Experience amazing at your Lexus dealer.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Perpetual Chess. Before I introduce our distinguished guest, just wanted to give one more mention. As I mentioned last week, Chess in the Schools, a nonprofit in New York, is doing a fundraiser on May 1st. It's a poker tournament to raise money for Chess in the Schools. It will be hosted by none other than Grandmaster Robert Hess. I went last year. It was a lot of fun. A lot of movers and shakers from the chess and business worlds. Chess in the Schools, for those not familiar, provides free chess instruction to New York City public school kids. They run tournaments, take kids to nationals. I used to be a teacher there, so I can personally attest that it is a life-changing organization. And at this particular event, you can play in the charity poker tournament, or you can just come out, come and play blitz and say hi if you go. It's a lot of fun. Rumor has it that one of the prizes at this, all the prizes are donated, and rumor has it that one of the prizes at this particular event will be a signed copy of our guest's book. And the deadline for signing up to attend this great charity event is April 17th, so please act quickly. And thanks, of course, to our sponsors, Chessable.com. If you sign up for Chessable Pro to unlock a bevy of additional features, be sure to use the link in the show description. And of course, Chessable has tons of new courses on openings as well as classics, including the beginner series, Learn Chess the Right Way, by our guest. Which brings us to our guest, who is a World Chess Hall of Famer. She was the top-ranked woman in the world at the age of 15, the first woman to earn the Grandmaster title by norms and rating, the first Triple Crown winner, a five-time Olympiad gold medalist, record-breaking university coach as well, of seven consecutive national championships. She's also an author. I'm a fan of the Learn Chess the Right Way series. I've long recommended that to scholastic teachers and newer players. And now she's out with an excellent, honest, eminently readable memoir called Rebel Queen, The Cold War, Misogyny, and the Making of Grandmaster. I really enjoyed it, and I am honored to welcome to the program Grandmaster Susan Polgar. Welcome, Susan.
Hi, Ben. It's a pleasure to join you.
Yeah, obviously, it's a pleasure to speak with you. It's I'm really touched by your book. It was not what I was expecting. It was very personal and not as chess-centric as I expected. Why did you decide to approach it that way?
I was trying to reach actually the mainstream audiences. What happened, I think, in 2019 is when the Queen's Gambit, the Netflix series, came out. I got contacted by a lot of media outlets, and they were asking me what I think of it, but also they were asking if the series were based on my life story, knowing that I'm the first woman to earn the Grandmaster title and all that. And while obviously it's not based on my life story, and it's based on a fictional novel, a story, but because of it, people were telling me, well, there should be a movie based on the real story, on your life. And as those conversations were happening in Hollywood, I understood that, as so often, Hollywood likes to take it with their own twists and take it in a direction they feel they want to take it. And I was recommended that if I want to have some kind of control or say of how my life will be presented, I should write my memoirs, and then potentially a movie could be made based on my book.
Amazing. And is there anything in the works in terms of a movie?
There are some conversations, nothing really concrete yet, but there are some leads, yes.
Okay, great. One thing that was really striking, as I said, the storytelling is very good. You and your sisters are great presenters and storytellers. So in a sense, it's not surprising, but still, writing is a different medium, a demanding medium, but you did a really good job. So I'm curious what that process was like for you.
Well, it took about 3 years. It was a slow process. I was kind of chewing on every chapter to make sure it's accurate, because a lot of the things happened half a century ago. So I talked a lot to my parents. I talked to former coaches. It was actually very interesting for me as well, to be honest, because there's a lot of things I didn't remember or I even remembered wrongly that I had to correct myself. And, you know, obviously I had the editors who helped a great deal as well.
Yeah. And one of the things I really liked about it is there's little life lessons in it. So obviously chess is a big topic, but as you said, it comes across that you were not writing this for only a chess audience. You wanted it to be understandable for anyone interested, whether it be in women's liberation or in just the Cold War or just coming of age stories. I mean, coming of age stories generally are obviously, there's a reason there's so many hit movies that fixate on those themes. But I like the little life lessons that you had sprinkled throughout. And I wanted to read a few and maybe hear you reflect on them, if that's okay with you.
Of course.
Okay. So number one is to set the scene for this one. So this is later in the book. Susan, of course, had moved to the United States, where she now lives. And the U.S. Olympiad team had surprisingly won the 2004 silver medal, captained by Susan. After that period, there was a plan for the team to go on a tour, do some events, help promote chess, and celebrate their great accomplishment. And it started to fall through due to some issues beyond your control. And you wrote this. You wrote, quote, "If chess has taught me anything, it's that so much depends on timing. You can have the strongest position in the world, but if you don't strike when the iron is hot, if you delay your attack by even a single move, then everything you've worked for can slip away. And that really struck me both on a chess front and on a life front. And I was curious, is that a lesson that you had consciously absorbed in your life, or was it more when you were sitting down to write and looking back at that period that it occurred to you?
Well, actually what happened was when I was just a chess player, before I became a coach, before I became a mother, obviously I was taking chess on a very technical terms as professional chess players typically do. But as I, you know, became an adult and had those other roles in my life, especially when I was coaching at all kinds of levels, I ran my chess center for 13 years in New York City before I started the Susan Polgar Institute for Chess Excellence, SPICE. And many times it was really important for me to translate the learning lessons that we can learn through chess to life lessons to my students. And obviously, after becoming a mother, raising two young boys, it was just part of parenthood. And basically, it was a process that in my 20s and 30s and 50s and now 50s, you know, it became second nature, and I think it's really important. And ultimately, the message of the book is, as you said, it's not just about chess. The ultimate message of the book really is that find your passion, dedicate yourself to it, work hard. There will be plenty of challenges and roadblocks and difficulties along the way. But if you have the passion and work hard, nothing is impossible. So that's the big message of the book. But as you said, within that, there are many smaller messages within the book, advice that timing is everything, as they say in this case, right? Just like on the chessboard or in the stock market or whatever you want to talk about, timing is quite important in life.
Yeah, it certainly is. And the next quote that really resonated with me, and this is one, Elizabeth Spiegel, who you probably know from your time in New York, she said something that really stuck with me. I think it was in, it might have been in Brooklyn Castle. I mean, it was in one of her interviews, but she was talking about one of the beautiful things about teaching chess to kids is that it shows them that adults can be wrong at a young age. And I hadn't thought of it in that particular way. And you also highlighted this point discussing your own rise, which obviously, as you highlight all of the roadblocks that were put in front of you, a lot of them totally unnecessary. You highlight this particular fact. You write, at 7 or 8, beating adults at chess taught me that grownups can be wrong about things. Therefore, I didn't have huge respect for authority. So again, and your father has such an outsized role in the book in terms of the life lessons that he imparted. I'm curious if that's something that he specifically told you as you were a young girl and your sisters then came along and were young as well, or if just chess itself just imparted that to you.
I mean, it was just kind of a natural feeling at the time. And actually, one of the things really attracted me to chess and kept me in chess was that, unlike most things, I obviously, a 4 or 6 year old child cannot be equal to an adult, right? Because of their physical strengths and size and knowledge and all those things. But chess could be one of those equalizers. And, you know, sometimes adults would argue with me, let's say, about a chess position, and they may be wrong. And obviously that at the same time translated in my mind as well, that if they are wrong about this, maybe they are wrong about some other things as well. Like, for example, I was being told over and over that girls are not smart enough to play chess. Girls should only be playing with other girls. Girls should play with dolls. Chess is for boys. So I kept hearing all these kind of sexist comments and mindsets, and it really bothered me, and I really didn't understand it. I genuinely did not understand that. Why wouldn't a girl be equally capable to a boy? After all, we're only lifting chess wooden horses and not real life horses, where the gender may play a difference.
Yeah, I mean, the sexism you encountered, of course, it was disheartening to read. Of course, you know the end of the story going in. So I know that in a sense, it has a happy ending, that you and your sisters persevered and prospered despite it. But what surprised me, and I guess maybe I had a little awareness of this, but the institutional roadblocks, the number of roadblocks that didn't necessarily have to do specifically with your gender. In fact, you highlight the event that just beggars belief that where FIDE gave 100 rating points to all of the other top women players in the world, but not you, and pretended like this was like a just ruling. Could you describe that incident?
Yeah, it's pretty unbelievable. It's hard to believe that they could push it through. Clearly, it was a political move. The Soviets did not like the fact that I was leading the world number one ranking for women for some time. And in fact, by that point, even after the 100 points, if you can imagine, I was still number three in the world. And the reasoning was the craziest. They claimed that the other women were disadvantaged, that they were playing each other, while obviously every woman had the right to play against men, and claiming that since I was playing mostly against men, it's easier to gain rating points against men, which is clearly not the case. It's statistically proven that it's not the case. In fact, I think I gained rating points practically in every tournament I played against women, including when I came back in 2004 and played the Olympiad, while obviously when I did play men, there were tournaments where I lost ratings. So I don't think I had any when I played women when I lost ratings.
Yeah, I mean, it's so implausible because, as you say, it's not like these women are precluded from playing men. They can play them too if they want. But on the other hand, I guess if you're going to do something that egregious, your explanation isn't going to be very good. You've got to go with what you can. And by that point, you were at least a teenager. Correct me if I'm wrong. So it's not like you were a little girl, but still, how were you able to set emotions aside in situations like that?
Well, it was really, really tough. This is 1986, so I was 17 years old. And two things happened kind of right after one another, pretty much, I think, at the same FIDE Congress. This 100 points got approved. And then a few months earlier, when I qualified from the Hungarian National Men's Championship to the next stage of the World Championship cycle, I was so happy. Wow, everything is amazing. All of a sudden, I'm being told that I cannot play in that zonal tournament due to my gender. And, you know, even one of these things is hard to swallow, but two, literally almost at the same time, it was really, really hard. I even, you know, contemplated giving up and, you know, doing something else. But actually, in these difficult moments, I remember my maternal grandma gave me some strength and put things in perspective. She's an Auschwitz survivor. And when I was complaining to her that how unfair, how difficult, you know, situation I'm in, she was telling me, oh, my daughter, you don't know what difficult is, you know, right, what tough is. And clearly, obviously, implying about the horror she had to endure in during the Holocaust. And putting things in perspective, I think, generally is an extremely important skill in life, as well as in chess. And I think that's perhaps, if you want to say, my secret to success in my career, both as a player, as a coach, as an individual, I guess, that I'm trying my best to put things in perspective and worry about things that I can change, I can control, and don't spend too much energy on things that are outside of my control. And basically, after putting it in perspective, I decided that I'm going to work even harder and I'll try to give my revenge on the chessboard with my results.
Yeah, and obviously you've got some great stories along that vein, like your win against Grandmaster Lubojevic, famous story that I know you've told many times, but perhaps you could briefly recount it for our audience.
Yes, that's a year later, 1987. So I'm being invited to this elite tournament with Anatoly Karpov and the other top 10 players in the world. And before the tournament, there is an article in El País, the Spanish leading newspaper, and in that Lubojevic actually being quoted that he doesn't understand how can basically the organizers invite women to such a prestigious event like the one I was about to play in Bilbao, Spain. After I arrived, the tournament started. Obviously, this was kind of the talk of the town that he's objecting. And I was very, very pleased that in round two, I gave him my proper answer, as I like to do on the chessboard, and I beat him. But I think that's the right way rather than with words.
Yeah. And did you have many interactions with Grandmaster Loboyevich after?
It's interesting to say that, you know, he was a good sport about it. And even though he had his doubt or sexist comments before, I guess I taught him a lesson and maybe changed his mind. And actually, we became quite good friends over the years. And we played many more times and had many social gatherings together during different chess tournaments. And no hard feelings, you know.
That's good. Yeah, because I guess in hindsight, like it's obviously you shouldn't limit what people can do in what you say, whether it's been done or not. But you were the first to reach the levels that you did. So, and we're all creatures of our eras. So it's good that he learned from that event and that you guys both were able to move past it. Susan, so one other quote I wanted to read before we moved on. This one really resonated with me, and it gets to what we were just talking about, your families and your decision to just play the toughest competition you could find, which, of course, in those days was predominantly men. And you said, you quote some advice that your father gave you. So I'll read what you wrote. You wrote, "Your father would tell you, there are two ways to climb a mountain," he would say. "Sometimes drawing a crude upside down V on the back of an envelope to help illustrate the point. One way is to take a winding path, zigzagging from side to side across the mountain's face, gradually making your way up, setting small goals and hoping that you get to the top one day. The other is the direct route, scaling the mountain at the steepest angle, making big jumps on your way straight to the summit. The main reason women hadn't excelled at chess as much as men, he believed, was because they had been forced to take the winding path. But to become the best, I had to set my sights high, not to limit myself to whatever the government allowed." So just an amazing quote. And you talk about this in the book some, but I'm just curious what you think informed your dad's perspective that this thing that hadn't been done before could be done and should be done in the way that he and you so eloquently described.
Well, actually, as I write in the book itself, he had this theory even before he met my mother, and he wrote the manuscript, which eventually was published in Hungarian with a title kind of like Educate a Genius. And he didn't know the topic or the subject of it will be chess, but he had this theory that any healthy born child with the proper circumstances and training can be an extraordinary achiever. And when I accidentally discovered chess shortly before my fourth birthday, it was perfect subject because chess is a relatively inexpensive sport. He already liked chess, even though he wasn't really a competitive player himself. And he felt that doesn't matter, you know, in chess, it doesn't matter if you're a girl or a boy, you can accomplish or have the same opportunities, which we learned eventually that that's not how the chess community at the time perceived it. But basically, that's, I guess, one of the positive side effects of the communist era, that theoretically, at least, everybody was considered equal. And it fit in nicely in his theories that you know, it's all about how much effort you put in, how much you work, how much you practice. As long as the child is healthy, you know, there is no difference from the potential of one child to another. And that was kind of the main thesis of my father's theory, who is an educator, a psychologist by education himself. And so he just basically studied a lot of high achievers in different fields, including chess. And he understood that how they trained, how much they trained, and he was trying to emulate that. And he figured that in order to reach similar heights, I need to, you know, walk similar routes, you know, that if I keep playing lower rated players, I will never get to where Bobby Fischer got or Anatoly Karpov or others, you know. So in order to even to have a chance remotely, I need to try my best who have similar challenges, similar amount of training and so on as the best players in the world.
Yeah, and obviously the results speak for themselves. And of course, you and your sisters were homeschooled, and you write in the book that this was not done in Hungary at that time. It's become a lot more common in subsequent years, but your dad was adamant, and obviously you were able to stay ahead of the school curriculum while excelling at chess, as were your sisters. And that brings me to the first listener question. So this question is from Chris Wainscott. Those who help support Perpetual Chess via Patreon can submit questions. And Chris first said, sorry, you couldn't make your event in St. Louis. I know you've been making the rounds, Charlotte and New York as well. But Chris's question was, if there was ever a time where you thought about bringing up your own children the way that you and your sisters were raised.
Definitely, I was thinking about it. Unfortunately, life intervened and I got divorced from their father when they were pretty young. And it was a messy divorce, and that made it kind of nearly impossible, because I have to kind of warn any parents out there who would like to repeat what my sisters and I achieved and what my parents did. It's a huge, huge sacrifice from both parents. And it's almost impossible to achieve the success we did unless the two parents are on the same page. And that's a problem in many situations. I know that one parent may be fully supportive of a child's chess career or other activities, and the other parent is not. And that's very hard then for the child. And even when both parents, like in our fortunate case, that they were both supportive, it's a huge sacrifice. Like, I remember my parents gave their all. They didn't go to theater, they didn't go to dinners, they didn't buy a car. They spent all their time and resources to advance my chess career and eventually, subsequently, my sisters, who are much younger. But it's a tremendous amount of sacrifice from the parents. And so, unfortunately, I was not really in those shoes to even seriously consider it by the time my kids were 3-4 years old.
Yeah, I think few of us are. I mean, it's amazing that not only was this not the full-time job for your parents, but you say your father at time was working two different jobs in order to help support the family. So to be able to do that. And I also think it's rare that there's this delicate balance between wanting the most from you and your sisters, but not becoming like a, quote, stage dad, you know, or an intense soccer mom who really comes down on the kid if they have a bad result. I mean, you guys obviously had mostly success, at least in terms of your results, maybe less so with the institutional roadblocks that we discussed. But do you think that secret, like, was he a competitive person when you guys did have setbacks? Did it really bother him? Or do you think that he was just invested in the process? And I'm speaking about your mother too, of course.
I think my father, what he was really good, had a good approach, that he was really focusing on the process more so than the result. He always would say that the actual result at the tournament is the outcome of how hard I worked or didn't. And that was always his focus, you know, that make sure you do your best in training. Because it's obvious that at the tournament, at the game, we all try our best, typically. I mean, when I don't, he would be upset, right? When I was really young, like 4, 5, 6 years old, and sometimes I would wander around who came in the door or, you know, get distracted. Those are the things he would be frowning on and disappointed, you know, but not because of losing. So he would work on fixing the distractions, the attitude, rather than it's never the result itself. It's a big difference.
Yeah.
Everybody can make mistakes, even with the best focus. But I do remember, and of course I have to acknowledge now looking back, that when I was 4 or 5 years old, I was curious, you know, I hear somebody came into the chess club, you know, who came in, what is he wearing?
Right.
It I was just a typical 4 or 5 years old, right? And, or during training, sometimes, I would goof off and he would remind me that you'll see the result at the tournament. You're tricking your own self, And so I think it's really important to focus on the process rather than the actual result. And in fact, during a competition, it's essential that whether a parent or a coach gives all the support and all the empathy and emotional support you can, because chess tournaments are really grueling, and I don't know any professional player who doesn't want to win and doesn't want their best, Obviously, if a student or a player, decides to go partying at night, that's the action that needs to be discussed, or questioned. It's not typically, the desire to win.
Yeah, it's great advice, although obviously easier said than done. And hearing you discuss that made me think of you, of course, it's become part of the chess lore. There's pictures floating around on the internet of young Levy Rosman coming to your chess center in Queens, as well as Fabiano Caruana. And you mentioned in the book that Levy, of course, you recall being an energetic kid, but no one knew he was going to be this massive YouTube star. But you said something interesting about Fabiano, which was that when he was about 6 years old, he didn't particularly stand out as a chess player. He was a good young chess player, but you weren't thinking this is going to be a world-class player. Now, I know that eventually you moved to Texas and eventually, obviously, Fabiano made his way to Europe. But I'm curious if in the subsequent years, so when he first showed up at your chess center, if there was ever a point where you started to realize that he maybe was destined for special things?
Well, what I really meant when I said that, I didn't necessarily see him becoming a world-class player when he was 6 years old, that there were other six-year-old boys that came around the same time to the club who seemed a lot more naturally talented, if you want to say so. Obviously, later on, when he came back to the by the time he was in his early teens, before he moved to Europe, it was already clear that he is a very bright player and has a huge potential ahead of him. And it I think, just reinforces my father's theory, who does believe that any healthy born child is a potential genius or high achiever, whatever you want to call it. That I do believe that passion combined with hard work is more important than natural talent. Mm. And even within our family, I remember when we were kids and Sophia, for example, seemed to be the most talented among the three of us. And as great and as much as she achieved, she was number six in the world in her peak, but relatively she achieved the least of the three of us, despite perhaps having the biggest talent. Because it's really about having the passion and having the perseverance and to keep going at it, how you handle the failures, the losses, the disappointments. It's a lot of things, nerves during the games. So it's a lot of X factors, and talent obviously is an ingredient. Naturally, the people like Magnus Carlsen or Nakamura are the ones who have the talent, who have the passion, and combine it with hard work. Those are the really, really special ones and the ones that have the exceptional results.
Well said.
We'll be right back with more from Grandmaster Susan Polgar.
Hey, this is Bill Simmons from the Bill Simmons Podcast, here to tell you that Michelob Ultra is giving the chance to win tickets to the NBA Finals. That's right, the 2025 NBA Finals. Just head to MichelobUltra.com/NBA Finals. Michelob Ultra Courtside NBA Finals sweepstakes. No purchase necessary. Open to U.S. residents, excluding Maryland residents. 21 up. Begins at 9 a.m. EST on February 16, 2025. Ends on May 5th, 2025. See official rules at MichelobUltra.com/rules for prize and details. Message and data rates may apply. Void where prohibited.
Spring is here, and you can now get almost anything you need for your sunny days delivered with Uber Eats. What do we mean by almost? Well, you can't get a well-groomed lawn delivered, but you can get a chicken parmesan delivered. A cabana? That's a no. But a banana? That's a yes. A nice tan? Sorry, nope. But a box fan? Happily yes. A day of sunshine? No. A box of fine wines? Yes. Uber Eats can definitely get you that. Get almost anything delivered with Uber Eats. Order now. Alcohol in select markets. Product availability may vary by region. See app for details.
Hattaday presents, in the red corner, the undisputed, undefeated Weed Whacker Guy. Champion of hurling grass and pollen everywhere. And in the blue corner, the challenger, Extra Strength Hattaday. Eye drops that work all day to prevent the release of histamines that cause itchy allergy eyes. And the winner, by knockout, is Hattaday. Hattaday, bring it on.
That's really interesting what you said about your sister, Sophia. So what stood out about her compared to you and Yuda? Was it her ability to solve puzzles, or what made you think she had the most talent?
Well, I guess my definition of talent in chess would be how quickly you recognize ideas, how quickly you pick up new information and are able to apply it in a similar situation. I guess that would be my definition of talent, right? Of how quickly, spontaneously you pick things up.
Yeah, that makes
sense. Versus others who need to calculate it through or need to literally thought it for more, you know, over more examples and more time. And Sophia, not just in chess, by the way, but pretty much anything we tried, whether it's ping pong or other activities, she would be the fastest initially in getting relatively good among the three of us. And then eventually, you know, she may or may not remain the best of the three of us in the particular subject.
That's fascinating. Well, we've got more listener questions to get to, so I'm going to read the next one. It's from Roy Lopes. Thanks for helping to support Perpetual Chess, Roy. So first of all, he mentions that your book, Chess Tactics for Champions, is a classic, and he's very much looking forward to reading Rebel Queen. And then he writes, you and your sisters were true pioneers who significantly elevated the profile and participation of women in chess. Reflecting on then and now, what's the biggest progress you've seen and what still needs to be done for greater equality?
Well, obviously, the biggest progress we made is the sheer participation of girls and women in chess. When I started out, I was practically in every tournament the only girl. And in fact, that was the whole purpose why I founded the Susan Polgar Foundation, due to the encouragement of the then executive director, Frank Nero, to help that. And that has been our mission, to get more girls involved in chess, give them more opportunities. And I'm very pleased to say that when we went back 10 years later, the numbers improved to nearly 15%. And I believe it's stagnating kind of around there since. But that's the good news, that the numbers have increased. Also, because of it, since there are more women playing, there are more women good players, grandmasters. I was the first one who earned the title based on norms and ratings. Today, there are a few dozen women who have followed my suit, immediately following my sister, nearly a year after me. But today there are 42 women, I believe, who hold the title. So we came a long way in that sense. I think what still needs to improve, the 15% obviously should go hopefully to at least 30-35%. That'd be nice. Obviously, we hope that there will be one day a woman who is overall world champion. My sister Judith reached the highest so far, being number 8 in the world. So there is a room to improve there as well. But also, I think as a chess community, there is need for further improvement. There has been numerous sexual harassment cases, sexual abuse cases, and at large, making women uncomfortable many times in chess clubs or chess tournaments. I think that definitely needs to improve. And if we're successful there, then we'll be able to have more women stay in chess. And if there are more women staying in chess, there will be, I think, more top 100, top 10 female players in the world.
Yeah, we have a few related questions that you sort of touched on from listeners. So I'll just continue with them because they're on this theme. So this one is from Courtney F. And again, you touched on this, but maybe you could elaborate. He wondered if you think the reason that more men play chess than women is related to differences in socialization. And then he asked if there's a way we can get the ratio of men to women closer to 50-50. And that one you did just touch on, but I'm curious to what extent you think socialization plays a role.
Yeah, I think very much so. And that is the reason why the Susan Polgar Foundation actually was fighting for hosting all girls tournaments as well. And in fact, in 2003, our National Girls Invitational was the first one to be approved to be an all girls national championship. And this year we'll host the 22nd annual edition of that. And the reason why I think it's also important to have all girl tournaments exactly for the socialization reasons, that the girls need to see that they are not alone, as they are in still in a big minority in the open tournaments. So they can encourage each other, make friendships, especially when it comes to younger girls. And nothing to do with chess. If you go look at 5, 6, 7, 8-year-old girls at schools, they generally hang together.
Yeah.
It's not until they become teenagers when they start kind of mixing more with boys, right? And dating and all that. But when they are in elementary school, it's just socially very natural that the girls have their own little groups.
Yeah.
And I think one of the reasons to encourage more girls to get to chess and stay in chess is to have those all girls tournaments, all girl chess clubs, because initially for everybody, chess is just a social activity. And only a small percentage of them will be tournament players, and an even lesser percentage may want to become professional players. So I think it's really important to also focus on the grassroots movement. And that's what my foundation is trying to help as well. And I encourage, obviously, other organizations also to do the same, to not forget the importance of all-girl tournaments as well.
Yeah, I used to run after-school programs, and I found that it was always challenging to, like, if you weren't making a conscious effort, you would end up with a lot more boys than girls. But even trying to go out of your way to make sure that you call on girls and make sure that boys who say rude things are held to account and that's not welcome, I still noticed, to what you were saying, that you needed to have some kind of critical mass often. You needed to have a few girls in order for them to stick around. And I often did find that to be a challenge, where maybe one would come, but then if there weren't more girls, they wouldn't necessarily stick around. So the work that you and Spice and so many others have done is certainly commendable. And Susan, it brings me to yet another related question from a listener. As I mentioned to you before we're recording, of course, you're a popular guest, so I'm glad to have so many questions from supporters of the podcast. And this one is from Igor Feinstein, who was wondering if the barriers that women face in chess, if in your estimation they've changed over the years, what the barriers are. Is that different from when you were a girl?
Well, obviously, there are more opportunities for girls today. While, as I mentioned earlier, I had problems even being allowed to play in certain tournaments. All the way from when I was 5 years old, I was told, no, I cannot play in the boys' section, to the 1986 incident when I qualified to the World Championship cycle. And I was not allowed to play in the men's competition due to my gender. So we came a long way when it comes to that. And I think it's still an issue for women to in the chess community to really be encouraged and accepted, that if a girl says that she wants to be a top 10 player, a world champion, girls are still being told that you're crazy, basically. Maybe you can be a women's world champion, but how could you become an overall world champion? And I think that's a big problem, because most of the girls believe that. And that's sad to me. And I think the main reason why my sister Judith and I accomplished what we did, because we didn't give in to that social pressure. We had that counter support, so to say, from my parents who believed that we can accomplish anything we want. And without believing in it, of course, women will not get where the top men players do.
And maybe this answers the last listener question on this topic. This one is from Basil Henrik, who writes and says, he wondered what you would recommend as an action to improve the level of play in a mixed primary school. So he says, for context, the participation in this particular club is almost 50-50, and everyone plays in the same competitions. There's no special girls' tournaments or prizes. The teacher is a woman, but the top 10 players are all boys. Do you have any advice for how to raise the standard of play in a situation like that?
Well, one of the things I always tell to kids as well as to parents of the chess playing kids, that it's very important to understand what the goals are for the individual player or family. Because one of the problems I think a lot of families face, that they just go with the flow and they don't have realistic expectations. So let's say if somebody's goal is to become a grandmaster, it obviously requires very different training as of methods as well as time devoted to it, versus if somebody just wants to have it on their resume for a college application one day, that I took chess in elementary school or middle school, right? So then there's a big range in between. Accordingly, kids are encouraged differently at home, in school, from their peers, you know. And many times the girls are not really encouraged to take chess as seriously, or even when they would be interested in, let's say, playing online like the boys do. They are said, oh, that's too much chess, you know. You need to also go to your piano lesson or dancing lesson or whatever, need to help mommy in the kitchen, whatever it may be. And again, I'm not generalizing here, but unfortunately in our society, there are still stereotypes that the girls have certain expectations from society, and so do boys. And, you know, I applaud the exceptions to that, where they support a girl when they want to do, which is still considered as a male-dominated field, but they certainly start out with a handicap. And that's what I keep saying in my different lectures, that as a reason why there are less women in chess, because it starts out at home. That maybe it's not the parents, maybe it's grandparents, maybe it's an uncle, maybe it's an aunt, maybe it's a sibling that makes fun of the girl who plays chess, that chess is not for girls, you know. Let's say they overcome that, everybody supports, wonderful. Then they go to school. Then it may be one of the teachers, maybe the peer pressure. Again, they may hear that chess is not cool. I don't know if you listened to the podcast that I was on with Alexandra Botez. And she was saying in the podcast that she was basically hiding throughout her school years that she plays chess, because it was not considered cool for a girl to play chess. And then let's say they are fortunate, they get all the support from the family, they get all the support in school, which is already a rarity in itself. They go to a chess club. And then at the chess club or the chess tournaments, they again can face these constant demeaning comments or unwanted sexual advances that, you know, a lot of girls face. So it's an uphill battle, unfortunately.
Yeah. Do you think at this particular school you mentioned with the Spice Institute, you do run women's only events? Do you think that the teacher should try girls' tournaments?
I don't know if tournaments necessarily, but definitely they should have all girls training when they can compete within each other, whether it's in puzzle solving or practice games, that they can be maybe even trying to train hard, let's show the boys. You know, there are many different techniques trying to encourage the girls. Obviously, each group is somewhat different, but I remember from the days I used to teach in my own chess school, as well as I used to teach in Harlem and in public school, the dynamic between girls and boys is just different. Yeah. I'm not trying to knock or say one is better or worse than the other, is just different. I think we have to recognize that girls and boys respond to different, and you may get the similar result, but you may need to kind of have a different lighting under them, you know, light the fire differently.
Well, we certainly appreciate all of your insights and obviously the trail that you and your sisters blazed for current and future generations. But there's a lot more to this book than the sexism you endured. There's a lot of fun stories as well. And I loved hearing about your interactions with all the world champions throughout the years. And we had a listener question wondering if you had a particular, and this one's also from Roy Lopes, if you had a particular favorite anecdote about an encounter with the magician Mikhail Tal.
Yes, I definitely did. And it was very inspiring, actually, for the rest of my life. I was just a 13-year-old girl. I was in Moscow, and I was just a spectator at a major international tournament ongoing there. And at the time, smoking was still allowed in buildings. And between his moves, Mikhail Tal was walking up and down in the hallway, smoking one cigarette after another. And I said, oh, what a dream it would be if I could say I played him a blitz game. And my mother was brave enough to go up to him and relay this message to him. And he smiled. He said, yes, I heard of Susan. And to my biggest surprise, within half an hour, he was back out. Apparently, he offered a draw to his opponent. He played Vaganyan at the time. And he says, I'm ready to play. And, you know, I said, oh, my God, how lucky can I get? And the first game, I played a brilliant game against the magician himself. I sacrificed two minor pieces. Unfortunately, the attack was only good enough for perpetual check. But I drew that first game, so I was very, very happy. But what was really memorable for me is his generous gesture of playing against a young player and spending his time with me. Later on, when I became a champion myself, I always remember that. And I also try to spend some time with the young aspiring players today who look up to me, because I remember how much it meant to me, him spending even a few minutes with me.
Yeah, amazing story. And I, having read the book, I guessed that would be it, but I didn't want to presume. So I tried to leave the question open-ended. And there was something else about that story of you and your family taking this trip to Moscow. You know, you're 13 years of age, obviously this being the chess mecca of the universe. But speaking of unexpected roadblocks, I couldn't believe the story about the coaching that you hired before going there. So could you share what happened with the coaching you were expecting to get in Moscow?
Yeah, so the whole purpose of going to Moscow was obviously to learn from the famous Russian school of chess and one of their grandmasters that my parents were corresponding with before we took the trip. And as it turned out, when we arrived, that particular grandmaster told my parents that, oh, sorry, I couldn't have told my real fee that I would charge for coaching your daughter, because my letters surely are intercepted, which was very normal back in those Cold War days, that people's international letters would be opened by the Communist Party people, KGB, and so on. So long story short, he says he just couldn't write in the letter his real price, which was 10 times higher than the agreed price in the correspondence. So that was quite unfortunate.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. You can understand why he can't write it, but he has a family traveling to Moscow, specifically to meet him. So it just seems like there had to be a better way than lying. Maybe he should have omitted it or something. But you ended up with those amazing stories. So I'm glad that the trip was memorable nonetheless. There's so many other stories. Obviously, Bobby Fischer became a family friend, and you write quite movingly both about the early times you saw him and as his mental illness progressed, as he became tougher to tolerate. Was there a time in his later years, did you guys maintain contact throughout his life? Or was there a period in the 2000s before he passed away where you were no longer even in touch with him based on all of the terrible things that he said?
Yeah, I was no longer in touch with him towards the last few years of his life. I don't remember exactly when we lost touch, but I definitely remember a few times he called me when I was still living in New York. So definitely we were in touch still in my New York years.
Okay. Yeah, and you do bring across this gentler side on the other hand, you know, him constantly petting your family's cat and spending just an untold amount of time at your house. And one thing that I maybe should have realized, because, you know, I've read your sister's books and, you know, read a decent amount about your family. But so I knew that it's a part of the chess lore that you had a lot of visitors. I'm friendly with Ben Feingold, who has some fun stories about showing up at your door. But it didn't dawn on me until reading your book how your apartment was just a two-bedroom apartment with already five family members. And then you write that you'd have grandmasters passing through. So you'd have like people just sleeping everywhere, famous chess players sleeping everywhere.
That must have been... it's really hard to believe it. Looking back now, we had about 600 square foot place. And at times we had five guests. It's pretty insane. It was like, you know, like sardines, kind of.
it's hilarious.
Yeah, the beds was like some kind of a version of a Murphy bed kind of thing. But five in one tiny room. It was quite something.
That's incredible.
We'll be right back with more from Grandmaster Susan Polgar.
Uh-oh. The last cookie.
You can get a new box of cookies in as fast as an hour with Walmart Express delivery.
Are you my guilty self-conscience?
No, I'm the voice offering you promo code EXPRESS for free delivery on your first order.
Hey, who ate my cookies?
You mean, these cookies?
Order now. Welcome to your Walmart. Promotion valid for first Express delivery order. $50 minimum subject to availability. Restrictions apply.
Popeyes has gone full pickle. Meet their new pickle menu. Pickle glazed sandwich, pickle glazed wings, fried pickles, and wait for it, pickle lemonade. You know a pickle thing this good won't last. Love that pickle from Popeyes. Limited time at participating U.S. restaurants.
Hey there, travelers. Kaylee Cuoco here. Sorry to interrupt your music, great artist BT Dubs, but wouldn't you rather be there to hear it live? With Priceline, you can get out of your dreams and into your dream concert. They've got millions of travel deals to get you to that festival, gig, rave, soundbath, or sonic experience you've been dreaming of. Download the Priceline app today, and you can save up to 60% off hotels and up to 50% off flights. So don't just dream about that trip. Book it with Priceline.
Go to your happy price, Priceline.
And we had one more listener question, and this one is related to your time as a college trainer. Obviously, this one's about Texas Tech, but then obviously you went on to win national titles at Webster as well. So this is from Zachary Haskin. He asks, he says, "Hi, Susan. Thanks for all your contributions to the chess world. My question relates to how you got started in collegiate chess. After all of your other successes, what interested you in entering the collegiate chess scene as a coach and program director? And what was your pitch to some of the original IMs like Gergely, Antel, Gabor Pop, and Dvorin Kuryasevich to choose a brand new program over the established programs?"
Yeah, so I was in New York at my chess center, and I was going to a lot of scholastic events in those days, and I realized that there were very limited opportunities for kids beyond high school who wanted to continue their chess careers with combining with their higher education. And along those same time, I was invited to Texas Tech, where I gave a lecture, a simul, didn't think too much of it, but the conversation got started. Would I be willing to start a chess program and, build Spice. And it was, a good moment because I started the Susan Polgar Foundation also a few years earlier. So it just fit in very nicely with my dream of widening chess opportunities in the chess community, bringing chess to the mainstream more. It was just a good timing, and I'm very thankful for the then leadership of Texas Tech. And it wasn't simple because they didn't have anything. They didn't have a chess program. You know, they had is a small chess club like most universities do. And we had to start with getting sets and boards. And when I first tried to recruit the players that Zach mentioned, they when I said Lubbock, Texas, they said, and where is that, you know?
Right.
Obviously, no, but not many people in Europe have heard at that time of Lubbock, Texas. And it wasn't simple, but I guess thanks to perhaps my name and reputation, I was able to convince the first international masters that came to Texas Tech and to the SPICE program. And I'm very proud that basically the first year that we had a Division One level team, we made it to the Final Four. And then by the second and third year, we won the national title for Texas Tech, which then continued five more straight years at Webster University. But obviously, the hardest was the first couple of years as of recruiting concerned, when we did not yet have a proven track record. Later, I could say that, well, all the students who come to the program reach their lifetime high peak rating while they are at the program. You know, I had to prove it. So I was very happy that the first IMs took the chance on me and on the program, and very proud that what the students and I accomplished together, and of course with Paul, who was also essential in building the program.
Yeah, this is her husband and collaborator, Paul Truong. And given all the success that you had, again, there at Texas Tech and then subsequently at Webster, I think some people were probably surprised when you retired and now you live in Florida. And obviously, this book, I think, may have been part of it. As you've mentioned, you spent years writing it and it's been a big project, but you're still in your 50s. You've got hopefully a few good decades left. What else are you or will you be doing to fill the time now that you're not running a top chess program?
Well, at the moment, I'm promoting the book. I'm hoping that there will be interest and a movie will be made of the book. Also, I'm working on a couple other books that are more chess-specific books. I don't know. I have some speaking engagements. We'll see where it goes. It has been so busy with the book release just a few weeks ago that I'll have to see where things lead.
Yeah, that makes sense. And another thing that struck me about the book that surprised me is how personal it is in some cases. Like, you write about both of your marriages and other romantic relationships and go into a lot of detail. Was that a tough decision for you to reveal as much as you did about your personal relationships?
Definitely. It definitely was. It was probably the hardest part of the book, how much to say. But I thought people may be interested. And in order for them to see a full picture, it's probably necessary at the same time.
Yeah, it definitely added to the book, because I've read other chess memoirs where it's just a catalog of their tournaments. And I always feel like that leaves such an important part of a person's life out. And when a person is playing in all these tournaments, even if they're having success after success, there might be something going on in their romantic or their family life that's actually the primary thing on their mind that entire time. So it's like when you read these linear chess memoirs where it's just like, well, I won this tournament, then I came in second in this one, and then I won this one. The game annotations are nice, but they often leave me a little bit cold. And this one did not do that.
Definitely wanted this book to be a human interest story and to reach wider audiences. Obviously, chess players may be naturally interested because they've seen my games or heard of my successes. But, you know, if that's all I would have done, like in Breaking Through, for example, which is a previous book I wrote about my life a little bit and my sisters and our games, then it would be a chess book.
Right.
Ultimately, this is not a chess book, but it's a human interest story that hopefully will motivate the next generations of young players, especially girls, that if they believe in themselves, they have the passion, work hard, they can succeed.
Yeah, it's inspiring. Now, one thing you did not cover is, of course, in the 2000s here in the U.S., there was an unfortunate period with these lawsuits with the USCF. There were so many, it's hard to even keep track. How come you decided not to write about, was it legal reasons or just didn't advance the story that you decided not to touch on those within the book?
Well, you know, that was a long time ago. I don't think it really is part of the topic of the book. That could be a whole other book in itself.
Yeah, I bet.
I don't think it was really a major part. Well, obviously, at the time, it was very unfortunate. But this book ultimately is to inspire young people, make them realize that there will be roadblocks. And I think I shared enough of those as it is in the book without adding that one as well. But unfortunately, politics can be dirty. That's the moral of the story there.
Yeah, which is not news to anyone, but still, yeah, not an unfortunate series of events for sure. And were there any other tough decisions you had about stuff to leave out of the book, whether they be of a personal or chess nature?
Well, obviously, in my personal life, there is a whole lot more stories, but for legal or other reasons, I chose not to include. But ultimately, as I said, I wanted the book to be an interesting read, with stories of other champions or the challenges or the state of mind and the approach, obviously about my father's unique upbringing of me and my sisters. So there are just so many pages of the book. So in a way, I think without, sounding immodest, I think I had a very rich life.
Sure. Yeah.
Even just my coaching career in itself could be definitely a book on its own, because it had so many dramas and interesting stories. Or even just my adventures with my sisters could be just a book of its own. Just so many angles, or my love story with Paul. I just had to pick and choose. And so did my editors, that you have X number of pages and focus on this more than omit other things.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. And yeah, the stuff about coaching these college kids, there was a lot more details than I had seen before. And really, you describe counseling students on their own romantic relationships and family lives. And obviously, it's a lot of people coming from very far away, a lot of European players coming to your university. So yeah, I agree that that could be its own book as well. Well, Susan, I really appreciate you taking the time. As we wrap up, I do have one more question for you. Now, this might be a little reductionist because it's, your family achieved so much and it's such an incredible story. Obviously, you're cited in like academic papers in addition to your chess legacy for what you and your sisters achieved. But if we could try to reduce your family's success, if there were one factor that were bigger than the others, what do you think was the biggest contributor to you and your sister's history-making success in chess?
I think it's the family unity, that we were, us against the world, basically, that it was that 100% support of one another. And especially, basically, throughout the 80s, when my sisters already played chess as well. And I faced a lot of the difficulties and discrimination from the then Hungarian Chess Federation. The fact that we all stood our ground together and we trusted each other 100% and believed in the eventual success, that 100% trust.
And so that was bigger than talent.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah.
I figured as much, but still, it's a good lesson to keep in mind. Well, the book is called Rebel Queen, The Cold War, Misogyny, and the Making of a Grandmaster. As you can probably gather from this interview, it's just an excellent and very eminently readable book. As I've mentioned on the podcast before, I tried to write my book in a readable style where you don't need chess diagrams. And yours, obviously, first of all, the stories you have are incredible. And the life you've lived is just incredibly noteworthy, but zero chess diagrams within the book. And people are always asking me about my audiobook. Susan, I still don't know when it's coming to Amazon. It's available elsewhere. I know that you have an audiobook, and I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, but someone else did the narration. Did you consider doing the narration yourself for that?
No, my accent is too heavy.
Oh, I disagree. You and your sisters have great English, but for those wondering, it is a great option for that small category of chess-themed audiobooks. So, Susan, thanks again. Any closing words?
Well, thank you, everybody, for listening, and hopefully you'll enjoy the book.
This podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Starting your own business can be extremely challenging. I know because of the challenges I faced when starting the Perpetual Chess podcast back in 2016. I had some good friends in the chess world, but suddenly you have to figure out a bunch of stuff like editing, finding guests, making a website, making logos. It was a lot to figure out. And I wish when I was starting that I had a tool like Shopify to help me get started. Shopify is the commerce platform behind millions of businesses around the world, and 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. is from household names like Mattel and Gymshark, just to name a couple brands. Get started with your own design studio with hundreds of ready-to-use templates. Shopify helps you build a beautiful online store to match your brand style. You can accelerate your content creation. Shopify is packed with helpful AI tools that write product descriptions, page headlines, and even enhance your product photography. Get the word out as if you have a marketing team behind you. Easily create email and social media campaigns wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling. And best yet, Shopify is your commerce expert with world-class expertise in everything from managing inventory to international shipping to processing returns and beyond. If you're ready to sell, you're ready for Shopify. So turn your big business idea into with Shopify on your side. Sign up for your $1 per month trial and start selling today at shopify.com/chess. That's shopify.com/chess. Go to shopify.com/chess.